I'm Robert Bound, and this is The Big Interview, our one-on-one programme in which people with extraordinary lives and maybe even tall tales to tell sit down to tell us what really happened, how they got here, and what makes them tick. Today, I'm talking to Simon Dupuri, the auctioneer and art collector who spent almost 50 years at the top of the art world. Starting off in Basel, in a sort of old world Europe of princes, archdukes and heiresses, and coming full circle to the art world becoming the new rock and roll of which everyone wants a bit. From hedge fund founders to sheikhs to oligarchs, Dupuri has often been in the room, and usually at the front and centre of it, atop the rostrum, hammer in hand, subtly pushing prices higher to rooms of hushed frenzy. The art of the auction is his. Dupuri's singular style has helped him stand out from the art world's various crowds too. Dressed in his signature double-breasted pinstriped Caraccini suits, Dupuri's look might be said to belie the rock star beneath. Of course he DJs on the side. Of course he's been described as the Mick Jagger of auctioneering. Some quick notes. Simon Dupuri was born in 1951 in Basel in Switzerland and has been the chairman of Sotheby's in Europe, formed his own auction house with Philips Dupuri, and he sold some of the world's most valuable works of art. And he says he's shy. Paintings, money, women. It's fair to say Dupuri's had a good time in the art world, and it's had a good time in his. Simon, thank you very much for joining us today. What was the last thing you sold?
Good thing. Well, we sold some paintings from a private collection, and it's a sculpture by Anthony Gormley, an artist that I like very much, both as an artist and as a person.
Yeah. Some of his stuff's difficult to shift around, isn't it? I mean, that's not the kind of thing that necessarily you can... Some of it you could actually conduct an auction standing on some of his more colossal works. Yes. I suppose it makes it easier to see.
Yes, I mean, obviously his works completely varies in sizes.
Yeah.
And I have even once spent a night inside one of his works at the Beaumont Hotel, where he did this extraordinary room that you see from the outside. You see this kneeling figure. And then actually when you go into the hotel, you can spend the night in it. And it's a little bit like being in a Swiss chalet because all the walls are in wood. And I love that smell that you get when you're in a wooden room.
And it's one of those things, people might expect Simon Dupuri to have a wonderful night's sleep within a work of art. It is in your blood, after all. How well did you sleep inside the Gormley?
I slept extremely well.
You're famous for this fantastic visual memory. It presumably helps you separate the wheat from the chaff in terms of paintings and in terms of the people that might or might not buy them as much as anything else.
Well, the great advantage if you are inside the art market, which is my case, is that you see on a daily basis hundreds of artworks. And the more you see, obviously, the more you learn. First of all, you never stop learning in this field. And I've been in it now for soon 50 years. But you don't ever get tired of it. And that's its beauty. But of course, it does sharpen your eye to see a lot of things. And that's why in the big auction houses in the old days, you would start, if you were a woman, you would start as a secretary. And if you were a man, you would start as a porter. And then by the sheer fact of seeing hundreds of, whether it's porcelain cups or furniture or whatever it is, you begin to see the difference of all the stuff you see. And that gives you a huge advantage over somebody who might not have the chance of seeing as many different works in a relatively short time.
There is connoisseurship at every level in the art world, right?
Yes, I think it helps to see a lot of things. But most of the people who have started in the art world have started in either the mailroom or in the, as porters, as I was saying earlier. So it is a job in which you start, and the only prerequisite is your passion and your interest and your curiosity. And again, these are things which never go away, which stay with you as long as you're in that field.
And tell us about where that curiosity and that passion and that knowledge came from.
Yes, I got interested in art. I mean, nobody in my family was in the art world, but I grew up in, and I was born in Basel in Switzerland. And that's a city which, despite its relatively small size, has a fantastic tradition in the arts. So without realizing it, I was exposed to very good art quite early. Now, my dream as a teenager was to become an artist myself. And that is why when I finished school, I went to Japan, where my parents were living. And I went to the Geidai, the Tokyo Academy of Arts, and took courses in Japanese brush painting, in Nihonga and Sumi-e, and really wanted to do my career in that. I rapidly had to realize that I didn't have the talent it needed to make a living out of it. And so I thought, well, the next best thing is to surround yourself with the art of more talented people than you are and try and make a living out of that. And I've never regretted ever doing that.
It takes a strength of mind and will to make these paintings and decide that they're maybe not 101%, they're not the 24 carat, but then to get on a plane to New York and try and sell them. That takes a bit of chutzpah, Simon. Tell us what was going through your mind, if you can still remember back on that plane ride.
Yes, I mean, I had spent several months in Tokyo and I had accumulated quite a lot of drawings and paintings that I did during my time there. And I was traveling back to Switzerland to do my military service. And I felt I would go via New York, which in those days, as today, as a matter of fact, was the great center of the international art market. And not knowing anyone in the art market, I bought the New York Times and I looked at who had the largest ads in the art section that day. And I decided I would go to the three galleries that had the largest ads, show my work. And if none of these galleries would take me on as an artist, I would go back to Switzerland and study law. So, you know, in the first gallery, I was there for 5 minutes and I was shown back to the door without having shown my works. The second gallery, I made it, I think, in 3 minutes and I was shown the door without seeing the director of the gallery. And then the third gallery, there was a lovely, very pretty secretary there. And she said, listen, the director is not here, but why don't you leave your work here and I will show it to him when he gets back. So I went to walk around Central Park and I thought these are the two decisive hours of my life. Then went back trembling to the gallery and I saw again this lovely young lady. And she told me, listen, Mr. Such and Such loved your work. And then I already was all excited. But it's not exactly the kind of art we deal in. And so that was the end of my career as an artist.
And there's always a point at which, there's always a crux moment at which things change. What was that moment?
After my aborted attempt to become a very successful artist in New York, I did go back to Switzerland, did my military service, and then started studying law in Geneva. And that was even more disastrous than my attempt at becoming an artist. So my parents, my mother in particular, got more and more desperate. And she knew Ernst Beiler, who was the most important art dealer, not just in Basel, but he was in those days, you know, globally, one of the top dealers. And she called him up and said, listen, I have this desperate case here. Can you please meet my son and talk some sense into him? So I went to see him. And then he asks me a very simple question. He said, is your love of the art, is it physical or is it conceptual? Where to which I answered, it's purely physical. Then he said, in that case, you should definitely not study history of art. You should go straight into the art market. And I said, well, that all sounds fine and nice, but how should I go about it? And then anyway, he gave me some practical advice of what I should do. So I am eternally grateful to him for having put me on the right path.
There is one thing getting an introduction into the art market, especially from someone of such high renown as Beiler. But it's the ability to imbue a sale, imbue the idea and the confidence of the market in yourself. Do you put on a sort of invisible cape before you go out?
I am basically very shy and introvert by character and quite quiet. But when I go into the rostrum, I somehow transform myself. And so people have referred to me as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah.
Maybe it has to do with the fact that way back when I started conducting my first auctions, I did it purely to combat my shyness. So I felt that I had to be particularly flamboyant to overcome that predicament.
There is a bit of a suit of armor that you put on there, right? These famous Caraccini double-breasted suits that you wear.
Yes, it has become a uniform in a way. So some people think that I have been wearing the same suit for the last 45 years.
It's lasted
well. And I do obviously replace it occasionally, but I feel well in it.
Well, I think the smartness in the art world has gone in and out of fashion. It doesn't do bad to have a bit of old world quality there, right?
I guess it's a combination of old world quality with being resolutely in the contemporary in the world and into the 21st century. Because at all times, what truly excited me and excites me as much today as ever before is to know what art is being done today, who are the greatest talents of tomorrow, try and see them and get to know them and discover them today. Because I was always saying at Philips de Puryea, saying we sell tomorrow's blue chips today.
Yeah.
And now, obviously, I love art of the past. I love art of all civilizations. And nothing gives you a greater treat than spending your day at the National Gallery or at Tate Modern or Tate Britain or in any great museum for that matter. But the true adventure as a collector, but also as a professional, is to try and detect the young talents, the best talents today. And when you see a young artist, even if you see that he's doing very good work, you still don't know how this person is going to develop over time, whether they will grow as artists or whether, on the contrary, if they are successful, they will just then try and produce works that they feel will please the market and then lose their creativity. You take a big bet, a big gamble, and that's what excites me and stimulates me the most.
This is what you feel like is instinct, and a lot of it is instinct. Is that something that has crept up on you? Is that something that you thought, bang, I think I've got this when I was 30 years old, you know?
I still am not sure whether I have it now after all of these years. You know, you just look at things all the time and then obviously gradually you do realize that you have accumulated quite a bit of knowledge over the years. And in that sense, it's a wonderful profession because the older you get in that field, in a way, the better it is. While I'm a firm believer that the art market overall will only go up and up in time for a very simple reason, that there's only a finite number of truly great art that is potentially available, and you have a growing number of potential purchasers who may wish to buy it. But within that market, you see the taste constantly evolves. And whatever we regard today as being particularly important and valuable, in 50 years, taste will be totally different and things will have changed. And it is not only in contemporary art that taste changes. Even in the appreciation of art of the past, our taste constantly evolves. And I'm always fascinated at studying the evolution of taste and then to see who is actually influencing taste. And in most cases, it's not people like us from inside the market. It's very often people who are outside of the market who have a much greater influence in the making of taste and in the evolution of taste.
I wonder, with your almost 50 years of experience in this market, in this world, Simon, whether you feel that the man on the street, the punter, actually learns more from visiting a museum than he does from maybe visiting an art fair.
I think it's important if you are interested in art and if we want to follow it more closely, is just to see as much as you can. And you should definitely not focus just on public institutions and go into museums. That's, of course, a must. But at the same time, you should follow all the art fairs, all the major auctions. And I always encourage people to go and visit auction previews. Obviously, even if you don't want to or cannot participate in it, these exhibitions are open to the public, and so many people are kind of intimidated of entering these auction rooms and going and looking at those things. But you learn so much, and very often you see outstanding artworks that you may not see again for another 20, 30 or 40 years. And so these are fantastic opportunities. And it's only combining all of that that gives you kind of a feel for what there is out there. So the public collections, the private commercial galleries, but also high and low. You know, I love street art. I love browsing and social media and Instagram and looking what is shown in various exhibitions around the world. It keeps your finger on the pulse. And the beauty is today, there are so many different ways for a new artist to get attention. He doesn't need to know the right people in the right places any longer. There are many other ways that he can break. So street art is one way. Obviously, YouTube, the social media, the endless ways through which a young artist can maybe get some attention.
When you see a young artist that you feel you've got a bit of a hunch about, you feel that the work's good, that it'll stand the test of time, that prices will increase in this young person's work, what is that artist like? Are you looking for signs of commercial nous there? Or are you looking for signs of being a bit wet behind the ears and you can give them the commercial nous?
The first thing I want to see is the work itself. And very often, I prefer to see the work without getting to know the artist initially. Mm. If I do like the work, then, of course, I am interested in meeting the artist. But if you go to the National Gallery and look art of the past,
you can't have a beer with them afterwards.
You can't have the artist there explaining everything. And so you have some people who are incredibly good at talking a good game, but you don't want to be influenced by it. I really want the work to speak for itself. Then, of course, since we have the privilege of these artists being around us, then, of course, definitely I am seeking contact with them. And I've seen that in most cases, when I like the work very much, I tend to like the person very, very much as well who has done the work. Now, I've just spent nearly a month in L.A. in August visiting a lot of artist studios together with my wife, who I work with. And I think we saw something like 25 different artists. And the fascinating thing was that hardly any of those artists corresponded to that romantic description.
Right.
Most of them were very much with their heads firmly screwed on, and they knew exactly what they were doing. Each step they were doing was very strategic in the way they were planning their careers. There was only one artist that we arrived, and my wife was very upset at me because I had taken the wrong road to get there. Anyway, we arrived 20 minutes late for our appointment, and to our great surprise, the artist was not even there. And then we called him up, and he was completely drunk, and then showed up half an hour later. And then he said, let's go and first have a drink together. And then we went to have a drink. 2 hours later, we all go, this time all of us in a slightly inebriated state. And then we arrived at the studio. He had lost the keys. We had to wait again 25 minutes before he found the keys. And that was the artist, as one imagined it, sort of the bohème view of the artist. But that's more the exception than the rule.
What about the collectors? Now, these are the people that you know exceptionally well, just as you know the artist, but maybe the collectors even better. You speak very eloquently in the book about some amazing Levantine branch of art aficionado. Larry Gagosian, who's an LA Armenian. You talk about the Mughrabis, who are Syrian Jews. You talk about Charles Saatchi, who's an Iraqi Jew. You talk about the Nahmads as well. What is it? Is there something in the water there? I mean, we talked about Basel having a pretty good kind of sort of artistic pH level in the water, you know? What is it about the Middle East that seems to throw up such savvy, tasteful people that can't seem to do it there, but chuck them to the United States, the United Kingdom, and they'll make millions out of art?
So you speak of collectors on one hand
and dealers.
At the same time, and I speak a lot about both in the book, and very often the best collectors are actually top dealers. And I have always often seen dealers who told me that they made their fortune not by the works they were able to sell, but in fact by what they were not able to sell, because that's what they then ended up owning and what then most increased in value over time. So I view collecting as an artistic pursuit in its own right. A great, great collector is like an artist. A truly great collection carries the handwriting of the person that has put it together. So, you know, some collectors or some dealers have a great, great eye, and all the people that you have mentioned are blessed with an exceptional eye. But when that comes coupled with a very good commercial sense, and you bring these two things together, then
that's
of course
the essence of the artwork.
It's a very powerful combination. And, you know, artists have always depended on patronage from, you know, princes and sovereigns in the past, and today from tycoons, whether it's in the finance industry or creative industries or new technologies, who then are the ones who have a great impact on the art world.
Is there an art in collecting? I mean, is there that sixth sense to that acquisitive thing as there is to the act of creation, is it?
I mean, you have many, many different ways of collecting. It's a human instinct that we all have in us, because I think every little child, I see it. I have a 5.5-year-old daughter, and she's obsessed with collecting little dolls, and she constantly wants to.
It's the same thing. It comes from the same
collection.
Place, isn't it? I mean, I think a lot of collectors, when they were kids, you know, collected football cards or matchbox toys or la la la. You know, it
yes,
comes from the
same collected
place.
All of those.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
And was obsessed with it. And so I think it's a deep
and
instinct.
All his CDs are in alphabetical order, ladies yes. and gentlemen.
So all of that is deeply ingrained in us. But then I think, as I said, you can do it in a very artistic way. Now, the difficulty and the challenge is to resist the urge you have. I have a bulimic urge in owning things, and sometimes you have to be very strict with yourself and to be editing your urges and go yeah. really only after the essential.
Always difficult to do in every area of life. There is a chapter in the book called The Women, by the way. I don't think we've got time for that. What we have to do, though, is get on the rostrum. You talk in the book about a particular sale of a work by Roy Lichtenstein, part of a much larger sale, of course, and you mention the two protagonists dueling it out for this remarkable painting. Just before that happened, before you did up the button on your Caraccini suit and you ate your apple, as you always do before you go up on stage, I'm calling it the rostrum, do you have a kind of pre-match thing? What happens? How do you gee yourself up to do that?
First of all, your analogy with football is very good because auctioneering is a team sport in the same way that Messi...
Is it, though? I think maybe it's... Yeah, Messi has a
Messi
team around him, though, doesn't he?
Or Cristiano Ronaldo, they do need a very strong team around them in order to be as successful
as
they
possibly
can. And so an auction takes weeks and months to prepare, and you have a whole team that works on it, and you have a team of specialists, and then you create a beautiful catalogue, you create a beautiful exhibition, then you market the sale both publicly and privately, publicly by doing exhibitions, privately by speaking to all the key collectors directly. And when all your homework was done properly, then you have the basis for a sale that could become successful. And then the auctioneer is just the final touch. Now, an auctioneer is like an artist. He may have good days and bad days. And what you want is a good auctioneer on a good day.
Now, and then we come back to you.
But I think that it's difficult to prove. But if you were to sell the same objects through three or four different auctioneers, you would probably get three or four different results. Mm.
So? So how do you, because this is the thing, your book is called The Auctioneer. Nobody does it better. You've been described as the Mick Jagger of the rostrum. So this is, you know, these analogies don't come from nowhere. There is how do you... You're a shy man who becomes an extrovert when you get up there with the hammer in your hand. Now, where does teasing it out?
I mean, first of all, I am scared to death before every auction I take. And before each auction, it's as if I had never done one before. Each one is like if it was my first. So you have all these anguishes that it's going to be an utter disaster. You have these anguishes. What if the room is empty? What if nobody's raising their hand at all? And you sink through all these nightmare scenarios. Yeah. And then once you're up there and you see that maybe it's not quite as bad as you feared, then you gain, you know, enjoyment and confidence, and then it actually becomes a very enjoyable occupation.
Can you use silences like Harold Pinter uses silences? You know what I mean? Can you use these? There's a rhythm to an auction, and of course, lots are put in a certain order to provide an element of up and down and drama and quiet, like a symphony. Do you do that on purpose now, or is that a sixth sense? Is that sort of second nature to you?
I think it is a sixth sense, but you're absolutely right. The silences are at least as important as the kind of reciting of the numbers that are going up, because if you just do it constantly in the same rhythm, it's very, very boring and can rapidly become totally monotonous and you send everybody to sleep. So you must obviously vary the rhythm, and at some stage being very animated and quite loud, and at some stage being very, very quiet, and some stages being completely silent. So people wonder, my God, what is he waiting for? And why is he not saying anything at all? And then you can get back into the action.
Ramp it up again.
And that's the fun part of it.
And what about afterwards? What about when you come off that rostrum? It's like walking off stage. It is walking off stage. Is there a warm down procedure?
It's each time a huge rush of adrenaline while you're up there. And then each time I'm totally, utterly depressed after the auction, regardless how successful or not it was, because having had all that adrenaline rush, you can't just go to bed and sleep. I'm incapable. It takes me several hours in a way to come back down. And it's purely due to that adrenaline rush. And also, when you've been kind of building up to a particular moment, and as I say, some auctions are the result of weeks and months of work. So when that moment is finally over, all that you've lived for being over, you have this moment of depression.
And I've always wanted to know, what's one of the things you've sold famously, or maybe not, maybe an iconic piece of work, maybe not, that you wish you hadn't, that you wish was hanging over your fireplace?
Yes.
Or maybe it is.
No, I mean, for a long, long time, I was not a collector myself. I mean, I was collecting, as we said earlier, little football pictures and matchbox cars, miniature cars. But then when I started at Sotheby's in my early 20s, I felt blessed to be surrounded on a daily basis by great art. And I was living in a room in London that had only one bed in the middle of the room, one chair and one table. That was it. Nothing on the wall, nothing else. It was very zen in feel. It was a very beautiful room. Maybe
it was good enough for Van Gogh.
It was the best home probably I've ever lived in. And it's only when I was in my early 30s that I, for the first time, spent quite a bit of money on something that I bought for myself. And that was the key step. And then when you do that step, the second step comes automatically. Now, every now and then I see something which I feel it's not enough just to look at it. I do want to own it. And I've seen that that first step can happen to anyone at any age. You have some collectors who start at 6, some who start at 66.
And what was that first? What was the first thing you bought?
The first work I bought was a painting by a Russian artist called Eric Bulatov, and an artist who today lives between Moscow and Paris. He did a big mural in the Garage Museum in Moscow. I love his work. He's also a wonderful person, a great, great human being. And at the time I fell in love with that painting, I saw an exhibition in Zurich. I didn't know how to pay for it because it was way beyond my monthly salary in which I was feeding already a large family. But I just, you know, took the leap of faith and eventually was able to pay for it and never regretted having bought it. But as I say, this was a trigger which then made a collector out of me.
And this is something that you can instill in others, this idea of it doesn't matter if you can't afford it, you must have it. I think this is the collecting gene, isn't it? This is the bug we've been talking about.
Well, collecting is a disease, and it's the best disease and totally incurable. And so,
and are you a dealer or a doctor?
Well, both, no. But obviously, you do want to bring people to make that first step and then to share in the passion and the enjoyment that collecting and loving art can bring to you.
And just finally, is selling a work more pleasurable than buying one?
No, the buying is the most pleasurable part.
It is.
It's a pursuit of the artwork. That's the real, real kick. And I sell professionally. That's as an auctioneer. Obviously, this is my job. But whenever I sold something from my own collection, initially my heart was bleeding.
Well, the auctioneer is, of course, Simon Dupuri. Simon, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
The Big Interview is produced by Bill Lutie, researched by Gaia Lutz, and edited by Claire Crofton. Don't forget to subscribe to this and any other of our programmes on Monocle 24. They can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, and of course, monocle.com. Until next time, all that's left to say is thanks for tuning in.